I'm Rachel, the creative director for Ram Dass's Love Serve Remember Foundation, and I'd like to welcome you to our Inner Academy, a virtual Dharma hall where our family of wisdom teachers will help you navigate your daily life by bringing ancient wisdom into a modern context. With over 200 hours of audio and video teachings, meditations, and practices from teachers like Ram Dass, Krishna Dass, Sharon Salzberg, Jack Kornfield, Roshi Joan Halifax, Joseph Goldstein, and many more, the Inner Academy is your core resource for finding balance, presence, and navigating the ups and downs of your daily life. The Inner Academy has guidance for every step of your journey. Choose from an annual or monthly membership and gain access to past and future courses, retreat replays, virtual community, and much more. If you've been familiar with Love Serve Remember Foundation for a while, you'll know that most of our offerings are given freely or on a sliding scale basis. So when you subscribe to the Inner Academy, you're paying it forward and bolstering our ability to continue creating accessible offerings for all in the future, as Ram Dass wished for us to do. Be here now and start your journey with Ram Dass's Inner Academy today. For more, visit ramdass.org/innerAcademy.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Welcome to the Sharon Salzberg Meta Hour. This podcast is a reflection of Sharon's very clear and profound vision of the heart-mind path. If you are interested in supporting Sharon's podcast, please go to BeHereNowNetwork.com/Sharon.
Hello. This is better anyway. How many of you believe in Mercury in retrograde? Do you know what that is? So it's an astrological configuration where things don't work. So Mercury is not in retrograde, but I keep saying I'm having my own personal Mercury in retrograde, which included, I mean, it's not bad. I mean, I've been on many flights and they've all landed and I'm like really happy, but it included going to the airport to get a flight to California and standing on line to board. And the guy working for the airline, who was really sweet, saying, oh, you should all sit down because this plane hasn't been cleaned. So half an hour later, I see everyone standing up. So I go to board and a woman makes an announcement. The bathroom's not working on this plane. Use the bathroom in the airport. And I thought, this is like New York to California. That's like a long flight. Then they announce, oh, the bathroom's been fixed, no problem. We get on the plane and we go out and they say, well, the engine's not working. So, I mean, it's sort of like that. So it's me, really. It's not the JCC and the quality of its equipment. But I am so happy to be here, even though I'm under inauspicious stars, it seems, mechanically. It's such a huge delight. I just saw these guys in California. And we will be teaching this retreat together, and I have a friend coming to the retreat, and I wanted to introduce them more to their work. So I've been on their website looking at videos and sending him videos, and so I feel like I've really been immersed in. I've done like an intensive with the Holistic Life Foundation recently. It's really great, and there are a number of things I want to talk to you about. I don't know if you want to talk about your work in general, but I actually want to thank you for your work, which is getting stuff done. And as I was sitting here, this story that had nothing to do with you came up in my mind about this time at the retreat center. I co-founded the Insight Meditation Society in Barre, Massachusetts, years and years ago. We had this really sweet Sri Lankan monk visiting, And he happened to be around the area of the kitchen when these two staff members, two people who worked in the kitchen, got into an argument because somebody had left these dirty dishes in the sink. And one was saying to the other, well, it's your responsibility. You clean them. And they said, no, I didn't leave them. You clean them. And they were just kind of going back and forth. And as they were arguing, the Sri Lankan monk went off to the sink and cleaned the dishes. And then they were done. It's like he just got it done. And that actually came up in my mind, thinking of you all sitting here right now. So I don't know if you want to start by talking about your work, how you started. And I have some specific things I want to ask a little later on.
Okay. Good. Ali, go ahead. You usually start the story.
How far? So good evening, everybody. I guess the Holistic Life Foundation, our focus has always been on yoga and mindfulness, meditation, breath work. Abin and I grew up meditators as little kids. Our parents were into the practice, so it was just something that was kind of around. Pictures of ashrams, yoga retreat centers, and yoga studios. I guess Abin was being carried, and I was just learning to walk. So it was just something that was around. Friend School Baltimore, mindfulness practice with meeting for worship and the pause before you do everything, the stopping for a moment of silence. So it was just our parents put us in all these behavior shaping institutions that kind of pushed us in that direction. Even the church we grew up in was a self-realization fellowship church. So church started with a meditation every day. There were incense burning, and there was like the guy that ran the services was all about showing the unity in all religions and the deep spiritual truths that were the same across pretty much every religion and spiritual practice. It was just something that I guess as little kids we kind of hid and took for granted. Like we didn't want our friends to really know that we were sitting around meditating. It's not as cool. It wasn't as cool then as it is now. Back then, I mean.
Yeah, and we're like from the neighborhood, like the epicenter where all the Freddie Gray uprising happened. So like, you know, real underserved community. So like kids, you know, they have fun with each other, make fun of each other. So we didn't want to give the kids any more ammunition. Like Ali said back in the day, you know, yoga and meditation wasn't popular. And then we were also vegan on top of that. So like we'd be outside. I'd be eating hot dogs out of a can and soybean hot dogs and. It was horrible. But I thank him for it now.
Yeah, and I think we joked around about our practice. Our dad would make us meditate every morning before school, and I think half of our time was spent actually meditating, and half of it was trying to get the other person to make a noise or laugh to get him in trouble. So it's just like that delicate balance between knowing what the practice was and being like a 6 or 7 year old just still trying to have fun. And obviously it stuck. I mean, it's something that kind of stuck with us. We started, I guess we got out of our practice once our parents got divorced, because each of them was holding a household. I mean, when there's two parents in a house, one person can focus on one thing, the other person can focus on the other, but then it was just two separate households, everybody kind of holding court in their own home, and our practice kind of faded away. We still had friends, we still went to church every once in a while, but our daily meditation practice kind of fell by the wayside. And we met Andy in college at a time, and I guess at the time we were all asking a lot of questions. We were finishing up with college, and things didn't seem to make sense to us. And none of the answers we were finding in our classes were really kind of satisfying our thirst for knowledge. It was just one of those things where it was like we saw suffering, we saw things going wrong on the planet. I mean, in our small scope, we didn't see people caring or anybody doing anything about it. And I mean, this is just coming from college kids. So, I mean, we didn't really have the big view of the world or a bigger or as large a view of the world as we do now. So it's just kind of like on a college campus, you saw like your people protesting or your people signing petitions to do certain things or certain like activist groups, but you didn't really see anybody actually doing anything. So we decided to start reading. We started going to all the small libraries on campus, like the physics library and the chemistry library and any library we could find that wasn't like the main library. We all went to the University of Maryland College Park, and we got out these books on like spirituality and ancient history and astrology and astronomy and anything we could find that just was going to kind of give us some answers. And we would share the passages we were reading, and it was just kind of, I remember, and we would sit around and watch documentaries all the time. We watched documentaries and read, like we were trying to search. We wanted to know what, like there was more going on that we felt, but we didn't know how to get to it or what that something else was. We knew that there was something else going on. And it was one of those things where we kind of went back to where we started. Our dad's best friend, me and Ahmed's godfather, was one of those people that got into yoga in, I think, the late 60s and never got out of it. Was just always practicing, but never had anyone to teach. We rolled up on, actually, Ahmed saw some books on his altar. Was flipping through them. It's old school Kundalini books. And he was just like, we're big into like superheroes and Star Wars and very imaginative people still to this day. And it was kind of like the books were showing these meditations that could, at the time, we thought would turn into like a superhero. So we were like,
I still remember like opening up the book and like showing it to my uncle, like, man, yoga can do all this stuff. And he was like, yeah, man.
And I guess the funniest thing about it was he was always trying to introduce us to the practice, but we weren't really ready for it. I know like there were certain things that we reflected on that he had given to us to try to introduce us to earlier. Like we would be at his house, like drinking beer, watching football. And he'd be like, well, you guys know that when you drink, you dirty up your body. But there's a breathing exercise you can do to clean your body. And just start doing the breath of fire.
That breath.
And we would be like, all right, this is weird. And we would leave.
Yeah.
And then, like, he gave me a copy of this book, The Holy Science. And I remember the first time I read it, I put it down. And I was like, this book makes absolutely no sense to me. And it sat on top of my PlayStation for probably at least a year. And I tried to pick it up again, and it made a little more sense. And, like, further along down the path, I read it, and I was like, wow, this book is genius. So just not ready for it. And then, like, the house that me and Atma grew up in, actually the house that me and Andy moved into after college, for a while no one lived there, but it was just, like, the house that when we were home from college, we would go to pregame in before we went out with our friends. Like, we would go there, and, like, there's a stereo, there's a TV. And in between the living room where we would hang out with our friends and in the kitchen – there was like a den kinda, and there was a bookshelf. We must have walked past this bookshelf probably thousands of times and never really looked at it. But later on, when we were ready for it, we went up, we walked over, and we turned around and looked at this bookshelf, and it had every single book that we ever wanted to read about yoga and philosophy and spirituality. And it was just like sitting there, we're like, oh, we thought we'd hit the mother load.
And at the time, like, we graduated from college, and we were spending all of our money on books and camping equipment, but it was like, you know, a godsend that, you know, all those books were right there waiting for us.
I remember how everyone kind of looked at us really funny because, you know, you graduate and everyone wants to go to some tropical island like the Bahamas and Jamaica, and all our friends are like, where y'all going? We just graduated. And we're like, we're going to the bookstore to get a whole bunch of books. And we would like be like negotiating, like, if I get this one, will you get that one? Deal, deal. Okay. So we just get all of them and then just pass them around to each other.
Yeah. And then we hit the mother load with the bookshelf. We read, it was the most amazing thing to us. Like, we were we're still pretty simple dudes, but back then our life was even a lot more simple. So we would spend all of our time reading and practicing. Back to our teacher. We told him we were interested in learning two things. He told us one was we had to agree to be teachers because he didn't want to be a teacher. He just wanted to learn. And he was like, you guys can teach for me. And the second thing was that we had to show up at his house at 4 a.m. the next morning to go out to the park to practice. And 3:59 in the morning, we're knocking on the door. There's no lights on. He comes out and we start up. We were kind of like, that was the beginning of our real deep journey into the practice. And we got into it and we kind of lived like monks for a while. We didn't really hang out with our friends. We spent all of our time reading and practicing and writing and like
talking about dreams.
Yeah, you know, it was just one of those things that we were kind of like we had like our own hermitage. Like we were.
It was awesome.
Yeah, I totally missed that time. We would like we would get up in the morning. We'd each practice at 4, or we'd go with our teacher, and then we'd kind of meet in the in me and Andy's living room, like around sunrise, and we would talk about the dreams that we had, books we were reading. Then we would go. And I don't remember during that time, I just got my dog, a rescue dog from the neighborhood. And my thing with him was we would walk to the park and I would practice mantra while I was walking around the park the whole time. And then we would meet back up. Then we'd do like meditation and pranayama in the evening. And then we would do more reading. I feel we were going to bed pretty early back then. Like our friends kind of thought they would come see us to check in on us. But I guess they thought we were kind of weird back then. We were just trying to figure it all out and then just kind of work on ourselves. And then
Whole Foods.
Oh yeah. Oh, this is a great one. So during that time we weren't working at all. We were just kind of working on ourselves. And it was funny. Like because we were dead broke at the time, and our parents would help us out. Like, our dad was, he knew we were trying to start something and trying to figure some things out, so he was taking care of the bills for us. Our mom would, like, drop off, like, a care package of food every once in a while. And it was like, we would go to Whole Foods every Tuesday. Like, that was our highlight because that was, like, the sample day. So we would go, and we made friends with the people that were the servers there. So, like, by, like, week seven or something, like, they would just give us, like, a full plate and, like, a full cup of juice, and we'd, like, go around and talk to them, and they were interested in what we were doing. So we were deeply into our practice, and I feel like the thing that made us want to start the Holistic Life Foundation were two things. One, when me and Ottman grew up in the neighborhood, it was a sense of family. It was a beautiful place to grow up. I mean, we spent just as much time as our friends' houses that we did as our own. There's, like, a kind of a built-in mentoring system where the older guys in the neighborhood, even though they may not have been doing the most positive or legal things all the time, they were still there for us, and, like, they were still trying to push us in the right direction because they didn't want us to do what they were doing. And then on top of that, it was kind of like they, I mean, I guess to this day, we still go and we seek counsel with them, we sit with them, we get knowledge from them. Like, they have a lot to share with us. And I guess the second thing was the fact that, I don't know, as we got into our practice, we started to feel really good to the point where people, our friends and family members and everyone around us asked, why are you guys always so happy? Why are you guys always so happy? And our thing was like, well, why are you not happy all the time? Like, well, there's something wrong with you, not us. And then so we decided that, like, when we walk out of our door, we could feel, like, the pain and the suffering of all these people around us, particularly in our neighborhood, because that's what we were most of the time. And then it was just like, all right, well, we got to share this practice with other people. Like, we'd be selfish to keep it to ourselves, and we got to keep the promise to our teacher. So Holistic Life Foundation got started, and then we kind of rolled from there.
Yeah, so just so we'll do a quick overview of some of our programs so you get an idea of what it is that we do, and then we'll keep asking questions, and you have any questions y'all have too. So we started with the first group of kids. It's 20, like, fifth grade boys. They were the problem kids in the school. They wanted us to be football coaches for them, and we didn't think that was a great idea to take the problem kids and get them to bash into each other. We thought maybe, hey, you know, we're feeling great. The yoga's changing us. Like Ali said, we walk out our neighborhood and we're seeing through different eyes, seeing the world differently and hearing through different ears. It's just a different place, you know? And we're like, well, can we introduce them to these yoga techniques that, you know, have transformed us because we saw what it did to us? They were a little doubtful, skeptical, of course. But they basically were like, who cares? As long as you take these 20 kids off our hands, we don't care what you do with them. And we would pick like half of them up at detention. A few weeks keep passing by, and less kids are at detention. And like the teachers and the parents and the staff, they don't really know what we're doing. They kind of got us in like this hidden room downstairs in the basement of the school.
Because this was like 15 years ago when yoga and mindfulness and all this stuff wasn't as popular as it is now.
Particularly not in Baltimore.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
So it's funny. They basically would say, look, we don't know what you're doing, and we don't really care what you guys are doing, but can you just keep doing it? Because they could see the difference in the kids, and they saw the transformation happen. We stuck with those kids. They all graduated into fifth grade. They all went throughout the school, and that's when we started picking them up on all different neighborhoods. We got cars. We look like clown cars. We pick up like 15 kids at times. So it'd feel like 15 kids all in our backseat, just piled into each other. We take them to a central location at the YMCA.
The police would stop us sometimes, just like, man, what are you all doing with all those kids in the car? And they eventually let us go when we told them that we're teaching them yoga.
Yeah. So it got great. It just kept expanding. You'd pick up one kid, and you'd have another kid next to him, and he'd be like, I'm coming with you today. And I'm like, well, who are you? I can't take you. That's like kidnapping, isn't it? I can't just take you. And they'd just hand me the phone and be like, here, call my mom. It's fine. And they just let us grab new kids and just kept growing. The program started with just those 20 kids. Now it's up to 120 kids, 5 days a week. It's 3 to 4 hours now. We do a bunch of incentives. Again, similar stuff that Ali and Atma were talking about with what they were offered when they were at friend's school, just these opportunities to have these enrichment activities to provide them with stuff that they wouldn't usually get to do.
Yeah, I know. And living in our neighborhood, honestly, and we went to, like Ali said, friends, and then all of our friends in our neighborhood went to the local public school. We saw the disparity in the educational system and the lack of opportunities there. So, like, we knew, we took the initiative and, you know, bought all the things that kind of increased our scope to our community school. And, you know, it's a federally funded program now for the next 3 years. So, you know, we're very proud of that, honestly.
What were you going to say?
Oh, no, I was going to say our after-school program is something like when when we got all of our enrichment partners. Because, like, it was funny, like, looking at it now and back when we were doing it, because that it was, like, just the three of us running around. Like, after the 20 kids, we shifted to the school, and it was still the three of us, but we were working with maybe, like, 65, 70 kids with three people. But, I mean, we were able to maintain and manage it. I mean, a lot of people look at us like we were crazy for doing it, but, I mean, it was just something that we loved doing, and we were able to maintain and, like, build up our fifth graders to help us out, and it all worked out. But and we didn't have any enrichment activities. We didn't really have any funding. But now with the way that our enrichment activities are, it's like we always joke around and say that we want to go to our after-school programs. They've got, like, steel drumming. They've got, like, a T-shirt design class. They've got a STEM music, class.
Karate stuff.
You know, wood carving. They've got dance. They've got basketball. They've got I know I'm missing some stuff. Oh, the Maryland Natural History Society that brings in animals for them to see and does, like, gardening stuff. So it's just – just to see the change in
the kids in our after school program, like they just bought some animals in this past Friday, and to see the kids in our neighborhood who were fidgety about dogs in the neighborhood putting, like, tarantulas on their arm and bearded dragons, like, it really, like, put a smile on my heart, honestly.
Yeah, and it's amazing because that first group of kids, around half of them are our staff now. So it's been 15 years since that, and that's kind of the way we work our programs. Our after-school programs, our training ground. We always say, y'all are welcome to come and visit and check it out. You'll see, like, a little pre-K kid in there leading people through breathing exercises, sun salutations, the works. It's amazing because we get them started early. It's always that reciprocal teaching concept that we have where we're teaching the students to be teachers the same way that our teacher taught us as well. We get highlighted a lot for that program. I think it's just because it's younger kids. They're in these underserved communities, and the pictures look cool. So I think that they highlight us for that type of stuff. But we do basically all underserved communities, drug rehab centers, mental health facilities, homeless shelters, elderly homes, any population that doesn't usually have the opportunity to get these services and these practices. We like to go into those communities. And that's where we really, really focused when we first began. But again, we noticed – you know, Ali and Atma went to a private school, and we noticed that a lot of these kids in these affluent communities are facing the same exact issues. And their stress is, if it's not equal, it might even be higher than some of the kids in some of these underserved communities. We like to always talk about the concept of, you know, Johnny in the underserved community may not have a mother there because she's passed away, or she's abusing drugs, or she's locked up, or she's just not there. So little Johnny in the underserved community doesn't get the love that he needs. But little Johnny in the affluent household's the same thing. His mother might be a CEO of a big company, and she's traveling all the time, and she's working all the time, and she doesn't have time to give him that same love as well. So he's not only missing that love, but he also has higher expectations too, because they expect more out of him, because he does come from a better family and doing all this type of stuff. So it's amazing when we go into those schools now and we use the same practices, the same concepts, the same techniques, how they just soak it up like sponges, and they love it. And you can see that they need it just as much as the underserved communities as well. So basically that's all we're doing. That's our goal, is to go around and to continue to spread the love and the techniques and the practices. We have other programs, which one is a mindful moment program. That's one in high school and elementary school. There's an alternative suspension room in the school, so students can be sent to that room if they're acting up or if they're fidgety or just not focusing. Instead of getting them suspended, you go and send them to our room. They do some breathing techniques. They do a meditation. They get a cup of tea, and they go back to their classroom. Last year at our elementary school, ended up being that there was zero suspensions in the entire elementary school.
And that's the elementary school in the epicenter of the Freddie Gray uprising. You know? Yeah,
it was funny because Ali was speaking to the principal and the vice principal on one day, and they get, like, a climate report. And
which tells about, like, kids getting in the fight, suspended, you know,
yeah,
stuff
all
like
their
that.
Data. And he's like, I see this is zero suspensions here. Like, did y'all fudge these numbers? You know, I know how principals do that sometimes. And they both start laughing. He's like, what are you laughing at? They're like, well, the reason we have zero suspensions is because y'all's mindful moment room. You know, anytime we even thought to suspend a kid, we just sent him over there. And the kid would come back and be fine in the classroom.
And to break down that program a little bit more, it's the Mindful Moment program. The principals give us 15 minutes at the beginning of the day, 15 minutes at the end of the day for, like, a mindfulness practice where we do, like, a little bit of light breath work, a little bit of movement, and then a silent reflection. Since we're in schools, we can't say meditation, so we'll say silent reflection. And then we also have four of our staff who, two of them are our former students, staffing the alternative to suspension room. And then we also have an initiative called the Mindful Ambassadors, where we've taken 10% of the school population and kind of given them further instruction in yoga and mindfulness in hopes to, saturate the school climate with it. And it's that's really been working. Actually, one of our mindful ambassadors during testing time this past in between two tests, we have this one exercise that's really good at getting rid of like test anxiety and ruminating thoughts and lingering thoughts and stuff like that. And she led her entire class in the exercise. Like, look, y'all, we need to refresh ourselves, you know, get those thoughts out of our mind, get that test anxiety out of our mind. And yeah, so she led that exercise.
And so basically, I mean, that's where we're at now. We've gone all over the nation. We've done some international stuff in Germany, Austria, Scotland, England. Might do New Zealand, maybe Jamaica. We'll see what's going on.
And another program that is really impactful that we do every year in Madison, Wisconsin, is a residency program where we like totally engulf ourselves in the school system for an entire week. We go in there the first day we're there. We meet with like a couple groups of students. The first day we meet all of the students in the auditorium and basically tell them what we're going to do for the week. You know, go over why it's important to be breathing in and out through your nose, the science of the breath, you know, a couple light movement exercises, and end off with a meditation. And then for the second, third, and fourth day, each of us breaks down and goes into a classroom where for that Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, we see every single student, and we kind of teach them a chair routine where they can kind of, you know, kids get kind of fidgety, so we give them exercise. They can kind of get rid of that bent up energy.
Ali was making a joke. He said he loves when you talk about movement, how you always go like this.
All right, so we go in there, teach them movement, teach them a couple breathing exercises the first day. Then the second day we go in there, and us along with the student is leading the exercises. And the third day, the student is leading the exercises by themselves. So once again, it's sustainable practice. And, you know, we train the teachers also. We give them cue cards or prompt cards when to use them to help them out with, like, you know, the classroom environment. Yeah, we go out there every single year, and it's a very impactful program.
It's been 6 years now that we've done that program, and it's super cool. Like, you'll come back, and the last time we were there, it'll be a kid who's been there for 2 years, and I'll be like, it'll be the first day, and we'll always bring up somebody like, hey, who wants to lead us through the exercise? And I'm looking, I'm like, all right, so remember, you're going to tell me, like, Andy, I got this, Andy. And I'm like, my bad, buddy. I didn't know you would remember. And he would just lead all the exercises. It's amazing. I remember the first year we did that 6 years ago. I think that was one of the first times it really impacted us, what we were doing. It was like such a shock when we're leaving. Like, the kids were like crying and like asking us to sign like autographs and like their dollar bills and t-shirts, and we're like, this is crazy. Like, we felt like rock stars, you know. It was amazing. And I think it was then that we really realized that one of the things that we do for these kids and these populations is we're making compassion cool. We're making it cool to help people and to be loving and to be giving, you know. And you don't have to be we call them like the main things most kids. You don't have to be a rapper or a movie star or an athlete to be cool. You know, you can, that helping people is cool. And at the end, it's so cool. At the end, we're always like, so y'all promise that when you see somebody, you're going to help them. And the kids are like, yeah. And we're like, nah, we don't believe you. Do you promise? And the whole school's like, yeah, we're going to help people. It's so awesome. It's so great. So we've lifelong friends there now. And that's I think that's enough.
How many schools are you in Baltimore?
13 now?
No, it's two more. 15.
15 now. 15 schools.
Working probably around 5,000 kids a week. Yeah. But it's not the three of us. We have we have a program staff of, I guess, somewhere around 20 right now. And a lot of them are former students of ours or former volunteers that we trained up. And they actually facilitate most of the programming in Baltimore. And we're in the office most of the time supporting it and running. I mean, we got a nonprofit to run, so it takes a lot of work. But, I mean, it's cool. We've kind of come – we're okay with it now. When it first happened, we were kind of pissed off. But we started to look at the fact that, okay, the three of us out there working, we serve at the most, say, 90 kids in a week. And now we're serving close to 5,000. So, I mean, obviously something's working. So we're kind of cool with that.
So I wanted to ask you a few things. You know, that's great. Thank you. One was about trauma. because of the experience of so many of the kids. And another thing I want to ask you, which we'll get to, is love is cool. But that's its own question. Let's start with trauma.
So in Baltimore, I know people have been talking about undiagnosed PTSD for a very, very, very long time. And I think there were certain things that we saw that, like, from our neighborhood and the kids that we were dealing with and their families and the fact that, remember when the Gulf War, I guess this was when we were going to Afghanistan, when the war with Afghanistan started, they were sending the doctors to Baltimore to train at Baltimore Shock Trauma so they can get just to see all the gunshot wounds and all the things that were going on. And then it was like, wow, that's really what Baltimore is at this point. And I know there were things that we saw in our students that we weren't – I don't think we knew exactly what was going on. We knew the kids had been through a lot, like kids that would when it was time to sit and meditate, like they'd be laying on their back in the corpse pose, they'd be sitting there, and some of the kids just couldn't close their eyes. And when we first started, we were like, well, come on, you got to close your eyes to meditate. But then once we started to think about it, it was like, well, no, there's a little more going on. Or like if you sit down and meditate next to a kid that wouldn't close their eyes, and then they sit, and then you're next to them meditate, and they hold your hand, and then they feel comfortable enough to close their eyes. Or kids that couldn't take their shoes off, or kids that couldn't take their jackets off, just little things that we're starting to notice. And we started to work around. And I feel like the three of us kind of figured out ways to deal with, like, just in meditation, always doing guided meditations and not giving kids the space for stuff to come up. Like, just a lot of little things that we were doing that that we saw where the kids could get into the practice no matter what type of trauma they dealt with at home or at school, wherever. And I think it just got to a point where once we started turning our programs over to our former students, like, they weren't as they didn't have the experience we had. So we saw a lot of things that they were trying to make the kids do that were kind of weren't helping the kids at all. They were kind of doing harm with the good they were trying to do. So actually, we brought down David Emerson from the Justice Resource Institute to do a training for our staff on what trauma was, so they knew exactly what was going on and with the kids. Because, like, it was stuff that we were kind of instinctively doing. Like, it was just stuff that we saw a kid doing this, like, okay, well, we know we need to do this with this student. And I guess we made a few too many assumptions with our new staff, just thinking like, oh, well, they'll see this too and they'll do it. But we wanted to kind of get them a little more formally trained, and things have been a lot better, particularly with the riots going on and, like, just day-to-day life in Baltimore. The kids, the parents, everybody's going through it. So we wanted to give our staff first to know what trauma was and then the ways that they can do the practice and teach the practice by doing the least amount of harm to the kids and the families they were working with.
Well done, Ali.
Well done. And do you have anything to add, any of you guys?
I know just one thing, just so you get an idea of kind of what is going on in these neighborhoods. I think that, you know, so you can really see the trauma these kids are facing. I mean, I know sometimes we're aware of it and we're living amongst it, but just some of the stories that we have that would always be, like, mind-blowing to me. There's one time in particular I remember there was a gentleman who was coming in, and he was talking about gratitude. And he was just telling people, you know, how you should be grateful for what you have. And he's talking about these villages he's working with. Was it in India?
Mm. Was it Kenya?
Kenya. Yeah, India and Kenya. And he's talking about, you know, oh, they don't, you know, he's storing their bathrooms and they have to pay to use this public bathroom and be grateful because you have a bathroom in your house and all this stuff. And he's talking about, you know, it's gratitude, this, and be grateful for this. And he's, you know, these people don't have water, they don't have electricity. And there's a little kid next to Atman, and he leans over to Atman and he says, I don't have water. I don't have any electricity. And it was like, you know, like that shock, like, wow. So we're like, you know, at the end, we're going to talk to him about it. And then so we walked up to him. We let him know, like, hey, we want you to hear what this little guy has to say. And when he told it, you could tell the guy was so blown away. You know, he couldn't believe that that was happening here, that he's going everywhere else to deal with these issues. And that someone in America, in Baltimore, was going through that same thing. And it just, it was so amazing how at times almost the trauma that they're facing it so often that it comes common to them. Like, they're cool with it. Like, they're almost numb to what's going on around them. You know, when we would go, we took these kids, that first group of kids, on a camping trip, and they're out there in the woods, and these guys are used to helicopters and gunshots and sirens. It's all they hear in their neighborhoods. And the sound of the insects freaked them out so much. You know, it was amazing. They were so like, oh my God, what's going on? I don't want to go out there. And I'm looking, I'm like, man, you're used to all this other, like, a war zone. but insects are scaring you, you know? Yeah. So it's amazing what where their thinking is and what goes on and how it really numbs. One last story I can think of, it was a pre-K girl, this little girl, Tajay. She comes into me one day and she's looking kind of sad, but just not like overwhelmingly sad. She's a little girl. I'm like, what's going on? She's like, yeah, my grandfather died the other day. He got shot in the head. And like said it so just like the mailman came and gave me mail yesterday type of, you know, like it was just so just like, oh, this is normal. This happens. And for this little girl to deal with it, you know, her resilience level already was so extreme because it was just like, oh, that's normal almost. So it's amazing to see what these populations, what these communities that we're dealing with really are going through. And I think it was important for us to be aware that, hey, this is going on and informing our staff. This is what they're going through. It's never usually that first thing you're thinking that's really bothering their kid. There's something underneath it. You have to peel back the layers and see what it is that's really bothering them to get to that core issue. So then we can be, you know, better serve them.
Yeah, I remember that there was one summer things got so crazy in our neighborhood. They implemented this thing called Operation Safe Zone that it was pretty crazy. Like, we never saw anything about it. We would tell our friends about it. They'd think we were lying until they came to try to come visit us. They never reported on the news or in the newspaper. It was like they pretty much just like set up like a like barricades surrounding like a three block radius around our neighborhood, and then like floodlights on the streets, and you had to like show ID to get in and out of the neighborhood, and like they had like
the blue light cameras.
The blue light cameras. Then I remember they had the cops on golf courts, like golf carts, like driving around the neighborhood, and it was just like, and that it did stop things. I remember there was a point like right before that where things were like really, really, really crazy. It was like some friends came over. I remember Yucca came through and the Ottman's house got shot like three times, and then like.
They weren't shooting at me.
No, just random, horrible aim. And then it was like, a bunch of murders, like right within like the two block radius of where we were. And then there's just a lot of stuff going on where the cops were, we got to shut this down and slow this down for a little bit. It's just, and everyone was kind of used to it. Like it didn't even seem out of the ordinary. It's like, oh, okay, well, I mean, at least nobody's getting shot. It's just like these things go on so much. Like Andy said, people are desensitized to it, but. I mean, inside, it's killing you. It's eating you up. So we got to do something to kind of help them manage it and get through it.
I know a story that pops up in my mind is the story of this guy that was like the head of the gang, the kids gang in our neighborhood. And he was a tough little kid. And we noticed that he would just sleep on our couch outside. And, you know, we live in like a dangerous neighborhood, that same neighborhood that Ollie was talking about where people get shot, houses get shot, and we have like those humongous like cat rats, like, you know, humongous rats.
They know. They're
yeah, y'all in New York, y'all know what I'm talking about. And this dude would sleep on our couch, and we would try to figure out, man, why are you sleeping on our couch?
On
why
the
don't
porch,
you?
Though.
Yeah,
on the couch, porch, though.
With the rats, you know, crawling across our porch and all that stuff. And, you know, one day he came up to me and was like, hey, my mom's sick. Do you think you can come over and, you know, help her out? You know, I know you know some stuff. So, you know, I took over some, like, vitamins and some tea and, you know, some oils and stuff like that. And as I'm walking into his house, it's like, you know, it looks like a horror movie. It's like maybe 10 gang members selling drugs right on his steps. So he doesn't want to walk past that because they pick on him. And he goes into his house, and his mom is like screaming in pain with like maybe like 20 different meds on her prescriptions on her counter, and like it's just looked like hell, honestly. And this is what these kids are facing on the day to day. So this same kid, you know, he had a lot of anger inside of him, along with a lot of his crew. But one thing that I've seen that kind of aided in, I guess, processing all the stuff that's going on in their lives and, you know, help them get past it is the breath and is the meditation and is the yoga. It's a lot of the guys that, you know, should be out there like selling drugs or, you know, in gangs and stuff like that. They're working for us now and inspiring their friends in jail, you know. So, yeah, they're dealing with the trauma, but, you know, there are ways as long as, you know, I don't know, there are ways to heal that trauma. Even though it's like really, once you get these skills of yoga and mindfulness, it's like basically being able to maintain your peace amongst the chaos. And that's what we try to do, honestly. We don't try to bring people to peace. We try to show them how to attain their own peace inside of them.
Because my fundamental question, you know, is about love. Because I know one can hear stories like that and, you just feel so much outrage. And I know, you know, when I write about love or I teach about love, you know, past and future, since I have the book on love, you know, and I think it's not just in those schools that compassion's not cool. You know, I think that there's a kind of message that love is a little sentimental or weak, or, you know, how is love going to figure in changing this scenario you talk about? Because I think so many people equate love with just being nice or giving in, or, you know, not having strength. And that's part of the reason I was looking for that particular video on your site. Yeah. And couldn't find it, you know, because I wanted to show it to my friend for that very question. You know, like, well, you can talk about the video I was looking for and what you did and what you believe about the power of love. Yeah.
So after the riots that went down in our neighborhood, we actually weren't there. We weren't in Baltimore. We were on a writing retreat. It was amazing. We didn't get anything done during the writing retreat because of the riots, actually. So as we get there, we're probably like an hour and a half away from Baltimore, and someone calls us like, hey, you see what's going on in Baltimore? Like, no. And we look on TV, and it's like our neighborhood. And we're like, oh, my God, this is crazy. What's going on? And we're just glued to the computers, just like, this is unreal. So we wanted to do something. We wanted to make sure that, you know, that we showed the community in Baltimore and really the world, you know, that, hey, that, you know, we're a resilient city, resilient people, and that there are good people. Because there was a lot of negativity coming from a lot of that stuff. Oh, look at all these thugs in Baltimore doing all this stuff. And the people in the neighborhood didn't feel that way, you know. Like, the next morning, everyone woke up. 8 in the morning, 6:30 even in the morning, and sort of we're cleaning. And like, this isn't us, you know, this is just a small group. They're overwhelmed. They've been basically just thrown everything against them. And it was time for them to just be like, we can't handle this anymore. So we thought it'd be a good idea to do a community meditation.
Yeah, because it was so much friction in Baltimore from everyone. And the only thing that kind of like alleviate that friction is love, you know?
And we wanted to make sure we brought, you know, from everywhere in Baltimore, not just from in our neighborhood, but from all the community. So we kind of just rallied and got on social media and all the people we knew. We told everyone to come together and to meet in the field right there, that the field that we did our meditation in. You can see basically the path of destruction that they walked all around and did. And we basically just let people know, hey, you know, that you know, all of us together and spreading the love and spreading the compassion is what can make a difference. It's something that we preach a lot when we teach our classes. We always are talking about love and that concept of it not being like the – Ali always has a great story of when we're in and we do like love talks when we go, like that residency program. We'll go into a school, and that day every one of us, all we talk about is love. And we'll start off, and it'll be little kids will say, so what do y'all think about love? And the natural response is all the kids are like, ew, right? And we're like, hold on, wait one second. We're like, well, what about your mother? Do you love your mother or your father? And they're like, yes. We're like, what do you love your teacher? I'm like, yes. Well, you know, like, how do you feel when someone says, I love you like that to you? And all the kids will be like, you know, I feel great. I feel wonderful. So we're like, so we don't get it. So why, when we said love, did all of you go, ew? You know, if anything, you should be happy. Like, oh, that feels great. So we had that conversation with them, and we tell them about how important it is and how it makes them feel. And we make them say, I love you to somebody in the room. And most of the times, or say, I love this person. And a lot of times they'll say their teacher. One student will say, I love Mrs. Such and Such. And then the teacher's just beaming, like, oh. And we're like, look what you just did there. You see that? And all the kids, you know, oh, that feels great. So I remember one year we did that in Madison, and one of the teachers came up to me. She's like, oh, my God, I got to tell you this story. She's like, the gym teacher came up to me today and said he's really nervous. He's like, I have this issue. This little third grade girl came up to me today, and she told me that she loves me. He's like, what am I supposed to do? I don't know what to say to her, you know. And she's like, oh, no, the Baltimore boys are here, man. Like, they had their love talk today. Everyone's saying I love you. Listen, you know, so everyone in the school is walking around saying I love you to everyone. I love you, I love you, I love you, because we're telling. And that's when he's like, oh, I didn't know. He thought the little lady was hitting on him and stuff. So, I mean, it's something that we've always used in our practices when we go and we're teaching all the time. It's something that we've it's funny because when it first happens, especially in the neighborhood we're living in, it's like really shocking to people. They'll look at us like the first day of them coming after school program, and it'll be a new parent, and they bring their kid in, and they come to pick up their kid, like, all right, see you later, I love you. And the lady looked at me like, who the hell are you? I don't even know you. What do you mean you love me? And then it's like she doesn't say anything. The next day, all right, love you, see you later. And then like 2 weeks later, she's like, love you too. And it just starts spreading. You know what I mean? I think that we always just bring that love vibe with us, kind of. You know, we're big lovers. We're always saying I love you to the kids, to the adults, to everyone. We're letting them know. We always say love is the most powerful force in the universe. And, you know, we love you all. And we see ourselves in you. So let's work together to bring the love everywhere. We call it like love zombies, that we're trying to create these love zombies. We're infecting each other with the love so that if you infect one person with it, then they'll go out and they'll infect more people. And the love will kind of just spread throughout the world. And it's powerful. I mean, it really is unbelievable how we'll have kids that were the toughest gangster kids in the neighborhood when they get off their phone and they're surrounded by all their homies and all of them are looking at them like, you know, if you say I love you, you're going to be soft type stuff. And they get off the phone and be like, all right, guys, I love you. And he'll hang up. And if they don't, he'll pick the phone back up, he'll call us and be like, hey, man, I forgot to tell you, I love you. And all of us are like that, our stuff. So I think it really does start infecting people and they start feeling it in our community in particular, where when we started, people would look at me like I was either someone coming to get some drugs or a police officer because I kind of stick out in the neighborhood with my skin tone. And now it's like I walk in the neighborhood and people are waving like, I love you. Hey, will you teach me how to meditate? And all this, it's amazing. And this is that same neighborhood where all that drama's going in, but it really is that sense of community is growing. And I think the love is a ginormous part of it. I mean, it's huge. I always say to people, I don't have any children like of my own, but on Father's Day, I get tons of text messages from the mothers saying, hey, happy Father's Day. I love you. Thank you for what you do for my children. Because they know that we're there for them and that we bring that love feeling all the time. And it's funny how it really does affect, because you start seeing them say, I love you to you all the time. And it's the same lady that will be like, who the hell are you at first? And now she's like, I love you. See you later, Mr. Andy. So it's powerful. I mean, it's something we've always do. And people now, it's funny because I think at times we just didn't even know that we were doing it. We just were caring and we wanted to help and we wanted everyone to kind of experience what we were experiencing. And the love, I think, just came along with it.
Yeah, I think one of the coolest things we do is we teach the kids to love themselves. Because, like, you're not going to get a kid to care about anyone in their neighborhood or in their family if they don't love themselves first. So I think that's where we start, is getting them to love themselves. Like, first showing them as much love as we can. In some places, we may not be able to tell the kids, I love you, but we can model love and we can show them that we care about them. And then they start to, like, well, maybe I am worth something. Maybe I need to take a deeper look at this. And then once they start to love themselves, like, then they can start to care about their family and their community and their friends, and you start to see them to be more empathetic and compassionate. So it always starts with yourself. Like, you got to love yourself first, and then you can move outward from there. And I think that's one of the biggest reasons that we've seen the changes in our community that we've seen, is that, like, we're in the elementary school, so we're affecting all the kids in the community. And then they're going home, and they're acting differently towards each other. They're acting differently towards their family, towards their friends. And as they get older, they're starting to care, you know what I mean? Not just about themselves and for the community. So they're going out and they're making changes with us or without us. They're going out and they're helping people. They're going out and they're volunteering. They're going out and they're doing more with their lives so they can come back. Like, we've got a brother and sister in our after school that start off an after school program. And one, they both got college scholarships. One's a pre-med, pre-dentistry. I don't know what Kareem's doing, but he's traveling, one of the smartest people I've ever met in my entire life.
Been to India before us.
Yeah, right. And the only thing they want to do is come back and help us. They're like, we can't wait till we graduate from college so we can come back and do what you did for us for other people. And I think it's a lot of our other students, too. The ones that were, that Andy was talking about, that group of 20 at first that are like 24, mostly about 24 now. But I mean, they've graduated from college. They could go out and get real jobs, but I mean, I guess they kind of do have real jobs, but real jobs they could go out and get. And
it's funny how we even say we don't have real jobs. Yeah,
I still don't feel like it's work, but it's all good.
I don't have a job either.
These are for a real job, but it's like they want to come back and they want to help. Like, they saw what we did for them and they want to do it for others. So that love zombie thing that Andy was talking about is happening. Like, people are. Starting with themselves and, like, whatever, and then they just want to do it for other people because, like, they don't want to see other people not loving themselves and suffering and sad and angry and all these negative things or all these other things, but they want to see people loving themselves and loving each other and building each other up, and it's starting to happen, which is cool.
And to build off of that, like, love is infectious thing, like, I know when we first moved back into our neighborhood, it was really like the Wild West. Like, you really couldn't really look anyone in the eyes, and if you did, you better have a gun on you. It was more like a survival of the fittest type area where people didn't worry about their neighbors at all. And like Ali was telling you all, that kind of broke our heart because, like, it was a serious community when we lived around there. And one thing that we always say is that, you know, the reason why people in the inner city call their neighborhoods hoods and not neighborhoods because there's no neighbors in there. You know what I mean? And I know one thing that we did is we started, like, getting all the kids that were just bringing down the property value and getting them. That's our second group of kids. We got them to help us build a park in an abandoned park, and we turned it into like we put grills back there, painted a mural, raised bear garden, we did community cleanups. So a lot of people in our neighborhood saw us caring about kids that weren't even ours. And, you know, one thing that we noticed is that it made other parents start stepping up and start caring for other people's kids. And, you know, and it's like Ali was saying and Andy was saying, like, we can actually physically see the change in our neighborhood. Like, when, like Andy was saying, like, when I walk my dogs in the community, people ask me, like, hey, yo, can meditations help me stop smoking these cigarettes? Or, you know, just the conversation is changing. Not because of us, but, you know, I think it's because of the whole reciprocal teaching model, and the kids are able to take the practice home. And, yeah, love.
Love. Yeah, you want to stand up and show the T-shirt?
Oh, yeah. This is our T-shirt. We're selling it online as a fundraiser right now. You all can get with Andy for the information if you all are interested.
It is so cool. I saw it a lot on the site. So maybe we can turn this over to you, and then if there's time, maybe we can be led in some breath meditation or something like that.
Sure.
To close the evening. Yeah. I don't think we have a microphone for you, so I think you're going to have to speak.
I'm sure there's a lot of strong churches in your neighborhood, which have important roles in the community. How's your rapport been with the established churches?
Can you all hear the question, or do we need to repeat it? You want to repeat the question?
I love you too.
They got to go. Bye.
They asked if we have a relationship with the big churches in our community. Honestly, they do have, like, some of those, like, you know, like, mega churches in our community, but it's for people not from our community. You know, like, people honestly will come into our community and with their nice cars and stuff like that, and then right across the street from our church, it's like boarded up house after boarded up house after boarded up house, drug market here, you know. So, I mean, We've done programs with churches, and we have great rapport and partnerships with them. But the main one in our community, to me, it doesn't really.
It doesn't really serve the community.
Yeah.
Probably small churches too, though. Yeah. I guess in the community that we live in, and most of our after school program is housed, there are some smaller. No, I guess the smaller ones have kind of shut down. Like, the big church has kind of taken over. Like, it's like the church in the neighborhood. So it's just
there's a bowling alley in the church.
Yeah, it's big. It's big. It's like a full square.
There's a bank machine in the church.
City block. Yeah. So it's like they don't. It's like Atman said. Like, you on Sunday mornings, and you'll see all the nice cars parked up and down on either side of the street in the neighborhood, and then they roll out. And I feel like that's. I mean, they do donate space to the school for graduation. I know we had the. Mm-hmm. The elementary school's graduation there, but I don't know of any specific partnerships with.
We'd love to be more involved. When we first got started, that was one of the areas that when we were first getting, we would do after school programs, community centers, and there'd be small classes in some of the more, like you said, the smaller churches. But now that one church in our neighborhood has really taken over, so it's not really. I can't even think of besides some of the people that just. It's kind of like a hustle they do in Baltimore too, where if you have a church in your house, then you get certain tax breaks. So a lot of people just do this, like, front door churches, but it's not really a church, you know? They just do it for the tax write-off. It's amazing, yeah. So we would like to get much more involved in it, you know?
They do feed the community and stuff like that. So, you know, I don't mean to say negative stuff about them, but it's just, you know, real stuff. Like, you know, they don't really they support the community with the food initiatives, but I think with the cars that they're driving, they could, you know, invest a little more.
Hi. So do you come to New York? And when are you coming to New York? And are you training other people? And how can I get involved? I loved what you had to say. I was a teacher for 20 years and been a social worker in New York City public schools.
Well, we'll be at Omega for training. Actually, this Sunday, I mean, this Friday, we'll be at the Garrison Institute.
Yeah.
So if you wanted to come up there for that, it's going to be a great time for caregivers. Yes. But if you can't make that one, we're doing another one at the Omega Institute in New York, upstate New York.
Yeah.
I mean, we're always looking
to travel
and do more programs. We do this program, we call it like a residency and training program, where we'll go into a school and we'll kind of we're good at getting kids and people excited about the practice, because one thing our teacher always told us is that you got to make it fun. So we make sure our classes are laughing and having a good time while they're learning the practice. So we'll go into a school. We'll usually start a school, and then we'll find 18 to 24-year-olds in the neighborhood of the school and train them to be able to do the practice so that we can kind of get things started and then have it rolling and let them take it over. We did it down in Charlottesville, Virginia, and the kids that we trained won an award for the Outstanding New Health and Wellness Program at the Boys and Girls Clubs in Virginia. We did it with a group from where's Fred from in New Jersey? Right outside of Newark in New Jersey. So I mean, we're always looking to, and we love traveling and meeting new people. So we're down to.
Have you ever come to a New York City school?
No. Please. Cards. Yes.
Do you let people come to Baltimore?
Oh yeah.
Can you pass them behind you?
The kids in our programs love visitors.
We'll get them at the end.
Yeah, we'll get them out.
You may leave the program with like some cornrows or something, but
yeah,
as long as you're cool with that, you're good.
But we love to come. We do that often. We come in and we can do trainings for the staff. You know, our goal is always, people always say we have a really bad business model because we go places and we train people and they don't need us anymore. And we're like, well, that's kind of the goal here, is we don't want you to have to keep calling us back. So we'll come any and everywhere. Just call us and we'll try to work something out and make something happen.
Yeah.
Thank you. I'm curious about your two things, the continuation of your own individual practices and how you have time for that and if that's a priority for you. And then also I am in the school up in the Bronx, and I'm a white girl, and I don't speak Spanish, and most of my kids do speak Spanish, and you know, I have 15 boys and 3 girls, and I'm teaching an after-school program, and it's been one of my greatest challenges and triumphs.
Mm-hmm.
I teach leadership, and so it's really about them. It's an after-school program. It's really about them, you know, thinking how they can get more involved in their own life. So, and I've been wanting so much recently to just tell them that I love them, because I do. But the challenge is, they sort of expect them to misbehave, right? And they, in engaging them, they do things like put their hoodies up and then like cover their whole face and then put their head on the desk. And sometimes some of the kids have special needs, some of the kids don't. And it's just like, I found out that my translator was actually punishing them. And then I was like, can I get in on that conversation? You know, so like, what's this gym time that he's not getting gym time anymore? So it's been, I think the biggest challenge has been that I don't speak Spanish. I didn't realize that they were all Spanish speakers primarily, but I just adore them and engaging them. And I love that you said, you make it fun. You know, I do my best, but I can't tell if I'm reaching them.
I'm sure you are. So kudos on your work. It's great to hear the work you're doing. Keep at it. You definitely are impacting them, I would say. And for your questions, I know all of us, we'd probably be crazy if we don't still meditate every single day. I don't want to speak for them, but we definitely, you know, we don't. I know I personally don't get as much mat work in, you know, the physical extra exercises and postures and poses, but I make sure I meditate at least once a day, shoot for 15 minutes each time, but I would say on average 10 minutes. I'm not going to lie and say that I get 15 in every single day. And then our personal practice is a little different as well than we teach kids, so we can't do mantras in schools. And I know that's part of my practice. I do mantras throughout the day, all day long. And then breathing techniques that we do too, whether I'm sitting in a chair or in line somewhere, I make sure if I do notice that I'm not being in that present moment or my mind's wandering again, there's certain practices that we do. So, I mean, that's the gist of my practice. I'm sure there's
similar. I know as far, I feel like one of the funny things is our current staff now, we've been having a lot of trouble with our staff kind of burning themselves out and getting overwhelmed and frustrated with the work. And the first thing we always ask them was like, when's the last time you meditated? You know what I mean? Like, and they were like, I'm like, yeah, so the reason that I'm and Andy and I were able to handle like 65, 70 kids with the three of us is we had our own deep personal practice. Like we were, like we centered ourselves and went deep early in the day and then at the end of the day. So it's just like, it does make a difference. And they were constantly, they were getting frustrated. They were getting angry. They were kind of doubting themselves. They were kind of, some of them quit. You know what I mean? Like they couldn't really take it anymore. And we were like, well, you guys are going to be like, cause the teacher turnover in Baltimore is some ridiculously high percentage, but we're like, you guys are going to be just like the teachers in Baltimore City. Cause they don't have a personal practice. And the only thing that's going to keep you going is your personal practice. And like, I feel like we wear a lot of different hats during the day, whether it's our jobs administratively or dealing with like kids in the neighborhood that may have to come live with us. I mean, we've all had kids live with us from time to time that need a little more support, or going out and teaching or putting out, like, there's just a lot going on where like we'll start our meetings with the meditation. Like if we have a meeting in our conference room, we'll sit down and we'll meditate with the people. Or I know days when things are kind of going crazy, I know I'll stop and like our outreach director uses our conference room. And I'll be like, all right, I need your office, get out of here. And I'll put them out and I'll sit and I'll meditate and then I'll come back out. I'm like, okay, now I can deal with all this. So, yeah.
And to build on what you were saying about, you know, you're like, I'm a white lady in the Latino community kind of. And, you know, I think a lot of that is just be yourself. You know, one of our best volunteers, we always talk about it, this girl, Brenda, super bubbly, really blonde, crinkly hair, and like when she like she talked like this, like a lot, like was her other every other word, like, but she was herself. You know, she didn't change. She didn't come in and try to be tough, be like, I'm from the city. Da, da, da. Nah, she was herself, and the kids ate her up. They loved her. She was one of our best volunteers, and we get that often. You know,
and we actually brought her on the workforce also. Yeah, she was so awesome,
and we get it often. You know, I look like this. How am I going to be able to go into those communities? You know. But I think it's two parts, and it's both with what you're saying. It's have your practice, you know, be what you're telling people or showing people and reminding people to do, because they're going to feel the authenticity and the genuineness of you and that you are in that calm state. That's why we don't burn out like some of our staff does, because we do have our own practice. And then just be yourself and let them know that, hey, I'm here for you and I love you. You know, it's hard, you know, especially in the schools to say that sometimes. We were just in San Francisco Wisdom 2.0, and there was a doctor that came up to me. And she said, you know, last year, the thing that I took the most out of this conference was you told me to say I love you to the kids I was working with. She's like, and I never did that. She said, I did that this year. And she said, it was amazing the impact that it had, because they care. It doesn't happen. But, you know, their parents don't say it enough to them. So for anyone to say, and then for you to be there every day for them, and then you're genuine with your practice, so you're going through it. So when they look at you, they're like, well, I'm not just doing this because someone's telling me to do it. I'm doing it because she says that she's done it, and it's impacted her in this way, and I want to try to feel that. I want to be we always say, be a scientist when we tell. You know, everything I could be telling you could be a lie. Do the technique yourself and see what it does for you to experience it. So I think you just, you know, having your practice and making sure that you can deal with all this external bombardment of craziness that's all around us all the time, and then just being yourself, I think it's going to go great. And if you want, hit me up, and we can do some Spanish lessons too.
Yes, you.
Hi, I am so grateful for what you do. I have a question. You touched on it just now a little bit about people who, and you're going to, it sounds like this weekend, doing a retreat on people who care and people who work with maybe young people, or I don't know what your population is. I spent a lot of time working with after-school teachers who teach in a variety of different kinds of settings and with all the different kinds of young people. And my role, in large part, is to find ways for them to build up themselves and to not get burned out and to make connections with each other. And there is a lot of, some days it feels like sometimes it's working really well and those bridges are being built. And other times there's a lot of fear and hesitation to have those kinds of, the kinds of trust and conversations that people need to have. And someone recently came up to me and said, you know, we need to talk about some of this really difficult stuff around race and sexuality and gender issues with ourselves, because we need to be able to feel more compassion and trust with each other in order to be better youth workers with our young people. And I wondered if you had anything specific that other than, yes, you need to build up your own personal practice. And we're I'm up in Cambridge in Boston, and we are increasingly doing more mindfulness strategies up there, and it's working, but it's slow, and we don't have anybody like you who just does it and loves it and is like all over everywhere. So there are little bits and pieces that are happening. But I meet with this one group every month, and I will bring your story back to them, and they will love it. But how to get them to and maybe the research piece is part of it too, like to encourage people to be doing their own research. But if you had anything else specific that you know works with the adults who work with the kids.
I know some of the things that work with our staff are like retreat, like getting them all away from their normal environment and getting them outside of their comfort zone and doing something with them. We literally bought camping equipment with our graduation money. So we're spending our time out. So we'll drag them out with us. It's not something they're used to. Most of them don't like it. But I mean, when you're stuck and you have to eat your meals together and you have to talk to each other and like there's no TV or you gotta, like, I remember we did our workforce development retreat. Like, you had to hike half a mile uphill to use your cell phone. So you really had to want to use your cell phone. So you were sitting there and you were talking. We cooked and ate all our meals together. And it was a great team building experience. People they had known each other, but they may not have liked or loved each other. Like, you're going to start to get along because you're dependent upon each person to do a certain thing to kind of, and it built our team up really, really well. And we went into that school year really strong. So, I mean, just getting them all together. I mean, even like, we do happy hour with our staff, you know what I mean? Just something to kind of get them to start enjoying each other's company. Cause the more that they can feel they can depend on each other, I feel like the better our programs are. Cause you know, that person's got your back no matter what's going on. And you know what, they know their responsibilities, and it works like a team instead of a bunch of individuals kind of trying to do their own thing. So those are the things that work for us.
Yeah. So I would say experiencing it, you know, like Ali said, either take them on a retreat so they can feel it or just give them the techniques. You know, I don't know how often we'll go into a professional development day. It's filled with all these teachers. 60% are probably all doubters. Like, what are they doing here? They're wasting my time. And then we just lead them through a deep breath and they open their eyes and they're like, part of my language, but they're like, holy shit, this feels so good. That's what they look like when they're looking at me, like, oh my God, this is crazy. And I'm like, yeah, you just took 10 deep breaths. Like, it's pretty amazing, right? And they're like, wow, can we do this more? You know? So that I think a large portion is experiencing it and do it with the practice or just that way of living, like I said, in the woods with nature and love and vegetarian meals and all that type of stuff. And then a lot of people, that won't work for them at all. That's where you do the data. That's where the research and the studies and the, hey, this is going on. You know that, you know, there's studies of, they have guys meditating and they're studying their brains and it's showing that it's increasing this and that and the prefrontal cortex is bigger and do all the jargon with the amygdala shrinking and all that type of, you know, like.
Telomeres growing back.
Yeah, and all that. Do all the scientific stuff, you know, because that's, so some people really eat that up. I remember there'd be times where we'd go, we'd give our whole spiel. I could have the entire community behind me chanting, this is amazing. And they'd be like, nah, we don't want the program. And then I was like, well, you know, we did a study with Hopkins and Penn State. And they'd be like, oh, really? Sure, we'll bring you in on Tuesday. You know, so it really depends. But those are the two things that we've noticed the most is get them to experience it or give them that data and that scientific backing. And usually that'll get them to get the buy-in and then they'll keep going with it.
Yeah. Thank you. Hi. I have a couple of questions. Do you work primarily with the elementary age kids, or do you have programs for middle school and high school students? And so my first question is in connection with that. My daughter is in an elite school here in the city, and she needs yoga and mindfulness a lot. She's very stressed in her world. And yet in their yoga class, which she does take, she comes home and she says, Mom, we don't even do down dog. I mean, we do the puppy down dog. It's so baby, Mom. It's so silly. And she considers it a waste of time, you know, and I don't think they've moved into a meditation practice. They talk about mindfulness all the time to the point where she's sick of it.
And so, they, you know, in that community, it's really kind of turned the kids away. And I was wondering, if you do deal with that age group, how do you engage them in a way that maybe is a little different from what I just described briefly?
How old is she?
She's 15. She's in ninth grade. And then my second question is very different. It's about the language that you use in the trauma environments. I'm working with a population that's in a very high trauma, filled with a lot of trauma. And I'm reading David Emerson's new book right now, and I am coming at it just from the yoga background, not the social work background. And I know the language that you use and the poses are so important. It's kind of like two ends of one of the spectrum. You know, you have the kids in the school who need it, but they're complaining that it's not enough. And then you have the trauma victims who maybe, you know, they don't want to be pushed. You know, so anyway, I was just curious to get your thoughts on how you deal with the trauma group, a little more specifically than what you were saying earlier, and then the kids, you know, who are teens.
I know one thing that we do with the kids that deal with a lot of trauma, like you said, language. Like Andy was saying earlier, we don't tell them to close their eyes. We invite them or welcome them to close their eyes. Also, in meditation, we try to do guided meditations just because if there's a lot of space in there, stuff comes up. So we just try to kind of like guide them the whole time they're in meditation.
And we work with kids K through 12. And the programs look a lot different depending upon the age group. So like our after-school program looks different than our middle school program, looks different than the high school programs that we do. And I think a lot of the ways that we sell the practice to kids, no matter what age, we make it really practical for what their experience is and what's going on in their lives. So like it's the same basic practices that we're teaching, but we're selling them to the kids a little differently. So if we were at Patterson High School, which is a school that was known for pretty much riots and fights, like we're selling the practice to kids one way there. And then we're at Friends School, where Otman and I graduated from. We were teaching, we did the senior seminar, the freshman seminar, we did assemblies for the entire school, the entire upper school. And they talk about mindfulness. They have a social worker that does mindfulness with them. They have yoga classes available at the school.
Meeting for worship every single day.
And the administrators were surprised at how much we got the kids to buy in. It was because we were talking to them about things that were going on in their lives. We weren't coming from a theoretical place of like, oh, well, let's do this pose. They're like, no, what's going on in your life? And just listening to them, you know what I mean? Like, there's, you'd be surprised what you can hear from someone if you actually just stop and listen to what's going on with them, and then giving them a tool that's actually going to work, and then like following up with them the week later. I'm like, hey, so we worked with this tool last week, so, and you said you were stressed out because of this. Did you try it? Yeah, so what happened? And then just like getting really engaged in what's going on and giving them, I think a lot of what we do with teaching, no matter how old the kids are, is about empowerment, like empowering them with skills to have control over their life and inner and outer life as much as possible. So, yeah.
Yeah.
You described how you go to Madison, Wisconsin once, been doing that for 6 years. And you go to other places, Charlottesville. You guys have been practicing for 20, 30 years, or however long you've been studying. You go into a place where the teachers don't practice at all. So how do you convey... How do you convey the information to a group of teachers in a school? I mean, how much time does it take for you to do the training? And you know, who's going to follow up? I mean, you after you go away, so it's hard for you to. You're trying to export your experience to other places, but it strikes me that's very difficult.
I mean, I know in Madison, the reason why it's so sustainable is because they have a great principal and administrative staff, and they check in with their teachers and actually carved out time for them to actually do some mindfulness in the beginning of the day. Also, we left them with those prompts, and the teachers saw how the students were engaged in the practice and were benefiting from the practice and more focused from the practice. So, you know, it makes their job that much easier. But if the administration and the principal is subpar, then, you know, the sustainability of the practice, you know, won't be there.
Yeah, I know one of the other things we do is when we go into a school and none of them have any experience with the practice, we won't go, but so deep, you know what I mean? Like, we'll give them maybe one or two tools. Like, we won't go in and give them like 50 different practices to do and a bunch of different meditations. We might leave them with a simple belly breath and some type of centering exercise. And that might be it. But those two things, if they can learn to do those two things very well, can be very impactful for the students. And then they're going to, and as they practice them themselves, they're going to want more. And hopefully they'll look for teachers in their area. Like, we're always recommending teachers in their own area or going to a retreat or a workshop in their area or something so that they kind of get, I don't know, they experience the practice, then they want more. So we're just there to kind of wet the whistle a little bit, and then hopefully they delve deeper. And I think teachers are really stressed out and overwhelmed. Like, there's a lot going on. So I think the combination of training the teachers and training the kids kind of takes some of the pressure off the teachers, and they can kind of let the kids also lead the practice. And the cool thing about the kids leading the practice is that the teachers can stop and practice themselves too and get the benefits of it.
And it just takes time. You know, it really does. When we did our program at Patterson, the engagement with the teachers was bad. They didn't want, there would be times that the announcement would be playing and the teacher would literally say, don't listen to that. We're going to finish doing the math. And so there's announcement of one of our voices saying, everyone breathe in deep, now breathe out. This nice soothing. And he's like, no, ignore that. So today in algebra, we're doing such, such, and they would just come and we would walk through. There was one teacher in the school who we thought hated our guts. We'd walk in.
No, he did hate our guts.
And we'd be signing into the office, and he'd just look, and he'd be talking to the teachers, and he'd look at us, and it just stop, and just give us, and we're like, why does this guy hate us so much?
You know when, like, people are having conversations, and then it just stops when you get around, and they just get quiet and look at you. That's what it was like.
And we just kept at it, you know. We just kept going, and we never forced it upon them. We just said, hey, you know, this is going to help y'all. You know, we apologize if you think it's taking away from your teaching time, but the goal here is that your students will be more focused. They'll concentrate more, and it'll help you while you're teaching, so you're not having to say, hey, Johnny, can you pay attention? Hey, you know, Stephanie or whatever, can you pay attention, whatever? You know, it'll help. And he now, after a year, and it took a while, is our number one guy. He dresses different. It's almost like he's like floral colors and stuff now.
He was well on his way out to school. He was like really burned out and hated his job, hated his students. Like Andy said, has a totally new vibe to him.
And it just takes time sometimes. And I think also just seeing the impact that'll happen with other classrooms. So if they're not doing it and they keep saying, hey, we're going to ignore this today, just keep doing the work. And they notice as the year passes that so-and-so, Miss Johnson's class really is going very smoothly, and they're like, why is your class going so smoothly? Like, hey, you know, those techniques are really working. Our kids are calming down. It just takes a while. So even after that first year, our buy-in with the staff was probably like 20%, 30%. It was bad. And we just kept going in and kept, you know, bribing them sometimes.
Yeah, I was about to say, we bought them too.
We would do professional development days. We'd go in, and the first time we do a little session with them, we give them some breathing techniques, meditations. And then we were like, that's not selling them enough. So we would like buy a lot of food. Teachers love food, free food especially. And we'd get some nice food for them, some salmon and some stuff like that. So they'd come like, really, y'all did this for us? And we're like, yeah, you know, we're trying to work together and just building that relationship. So it took a while. And now still, it's still not 100% engagement. We come in there sometimes and still, I swear, some of the teachers look at us like, these guys again, goodness gracious. You know, but just time and time and building and just trying to make it that not only you're making the impact and going in and checking up on them, but then the students are doing the same thing. It just, yeah.
So we're going to have to close. We have like 1 minute for meditation. I don't know, can you stick around for a few minutes if people have questions?
Of course, for sure.
You can come up, and I want to remind you about the Garrison Institute retreat. The Garrison Institute retreat, which starts tomorrow night.
It's going to be awesome.
And we're really lucky in that there's really quite a bit of scholarship money that's been donated for this retreat. So if that is an issue that has you hesitating, you know, I don't know that it all will be a problem, really. So you can talk to Jane or Chris or, you know, John. There are people here from the Garrison Institute. So then we can continue the conversation immediately if you come. So do you want to lead us in a one-minute meditation? You got one?
You want to do one?
Rock, paper, scissors.
You want to lead us in a two-minute meditation?
Loving kindness. Breath or loving kindness, which one you want to do?
All right.
I guess everybody can just sit. Right. Yes.
Yeah, like when you said you go in and you just do simple centering or simple breath.
No problem.
Like,
yep. Thank you. This one that Ottman's about to do, he does a lot just because it, like it gives the kids the space for some calm and like some inner peace, but it also is like you'll notice it's very well guided all the way through. There's no like big chunks of open space in the meditation for anything to come up. So it's good. The kids love it, and it's cool to hear the kids teach it too, because they start to learn it and they start to be able to go through it, and then they'll come up to the front and they'll lead their friends through the guided meditation.
All right. So if everybody could sit with your back, neck, and head aligned, feet grounded. And, you know, we invite you to close your eyes. And we're going to start off by doing a couple deep breaths together in and out of our nose. So everyone inhale long, slow, and deep in through your nose, filling your stomach up with air. Long, slow, deep breath. And then exhale that breath out, push it all out, squeeze your stomach in, push all that air out. Inhale deep again. Long, slow, deep breath, filling your stomach up with air. And exhale, push all that air out, push it all out. Inhale one more time with that long, slow, deep breath, filling your stomach up with air. And exhale, push all that air out, push it all out. Now just breathe on your own. Don't put any effort into it. Just make sure you're breathing in and out through your nose at a nice natural pace. And now we're going to start using our imaginations. Every time we inhale, we're going to feel and see ourselves pulling all the positive energy that the earth has to offer us inside our body with that in-breath. Really feel and see that happen on that inhale. And on that exhale, push any stress, any anger, any disease, any ailments, anything that's inside your body that you don't want in there, see it leave your body with the breath. And you know, just like in life, when you meditate, you can get distracted. If you get distracted by a thought or a sound, it's cool to acknowledge a thought or sound. But remember, just be self-disciplined enough to bring yourself back to the breath. And on that inhale, pulling in that positive energy from the earth. And on that exhale, push any negative energy that's inside your body that you want out. Really feel and see it leave your body with that exhale. All right, we're going to use our imaginations again. And this time, every time we inhale, we're going to feel and see ourselves pulling all the healing oxygen off the trees, plants, and bodies of water. Really feel and see it come in your body with that inhale and energize your muscles, bones, and organs. Really use your imagination to feel and see that happen. And every exhale, push all the stale carbon dioxide out of your body and feed the trees and plants that gave us oxygen. You know, once again, every inhale, pulling in that healing oxygen, energizing your muscles, bones, and organs. Every exhale, pushing out that stale carbon dioxide. All right, we're going to use our imaginations again. And this time we're going to think about all those people that we love, whether it's our family or friends, no matter how far away they live, no matter if they're living or not, love knows no boundaries. So with every breath, send your loved ones love with that breath. All right, we're going to use our imaginations again. And this time we're going to think about all those people that stress us out or make us angry, whether it's our family or friends, coworkers, people in our neighborhood. But be the bigger person and send those people love too. We all know the law of karma. Whatever energy we put out there, it comes back to us. So even though they're sending us negative energy or they make us angry, send those people back love because they probably need it. All right, we're going to use our imaginations again. And this time we're going to focus on ourselves. We send love to all people all the time, but a lot of the time we forget to send love to ourselves. So right now we're going to focus that breath on sending love to ourselves. All right, everyone, keep your eyes closed, and we're going to bring ourselves back to our bodies. Start wiggling your toes and your fingers. Roll your ankles and your wrists, and do a neck roll both ways just to stretch your neck out a little bit. And then you can slowly, slowly blink your eyes open and come back to your senses. All right.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank y'all. Love y'all.
Thank you, Susie.